also. So one of you wrote me a personal note commenting that while feeling that you had received a tremendous amount of kindness, service from others over the course of your life, but kind of felt somewhat a little bit of grief or sadness of not being able to offer more back. So it's actually a very noble perspective. It's one actively cultivated in Bodhisattva practice, of attending constantly to the kindness of others and feeling, as Shantideva writes, that even when you're walking down the street and you see people passing by, attending to each one, feeling a sense of gratitude for total strangers, feeling independence upon such a person, this person, I can achieve enlightenment. And being aware of this tremendous network, again, causality figures so utterly central to, or centrally to Buddhism. And that is in terms of causality. It's only a matter of, you know, connections to see how this person actually has contributed to your well-being, directly, indirectly, but the network of causality of all of the causes that are coming together from around the world to allow us to survive, to flourish, let alone to find Dharma and to practice Dharma, is, you know, pretty much it encompasses the entire globe. But then that sense of, it can be a sense of happy indebtedness, giving rise to a really noble question, and that is, how can I do more? How can I be of greater service? It's a wonderful question. And of course, what leaps to my mind is that there are different ways of being of service. Hedonically, for example. Hedonically, and that is, people have material needs, including, let's look at the basic ones, food, shelter, clothing, education, medical care, just meeting the basic requisites of life. These are very important. And depending on one's own personal inclinations, one's talents, one's skills, one's interests, perhaps one may feel in this lifetime, I think that's my calling. And it's not calling from somebody else. That's where I feel moved inwardly. That's where I think I could really make a contribution. And it can be in all different types of right livelihood. Shantideva says there's nothing a bodhisattva won't learn. You know, there's no kind of janitorial work. Or, I don't know, any kind of thing. Obviously not obviously not injurious behavior. That's not worthwhile, but that kind of goes without saying. But a bodhisattva will learn all kinds of things in order to be able to be of service to people in all different manner of ways. So there's no elitism there. A thing, oh, well, we bodhisattvas don't do that. Maid service, oh, not for us bodhisattvas. No, maid service, be a terrific bodhisattva maid, you know. So there it is. So there are these different avenues. In terms of serving hedonically, this would be acquiring perhaps more education, more knowledge, more skills. And then the three jewels of the mundane world can be very useful, just like any old jewel, like a ruby, a diamond, and a sapphire. Wealth can be very useful. If you have a real knack for making money, I want to be your friend. Oh, no, wait. Scratch that. That just slipped out. If you have a knack for making money, money can be used for a lot of really good things. You know? And there are a lot of wealthy people who are using their wealth for wonderfully benevolent things. Very helpful. Power, political power, and so forth, can be tremendously helpful. True, isn't it? And then fame, celebrity, status, prestige, renown. That's just like a jewel. You can use it to throw somebody and put a dent in their head, or you can use it to really do some good in the world as well. So they're for the mundane. But then, and again, I think you see that I'm speaking with respect here. There's no disparagement. There's no but. No, that's that. Really, really beneficial. Really meaningful. It's an and. Can we serve others eudaimonically? And we serve others to really help them identify and alleviate the true causes of suffering. Identify and cultivate the true causes of happiness. Could we help people actually find a path to liberation and awakening? And not only find the path, but perhaps then take them by the hand and guide them step by step along the way. Really, is there any greater service than that? And I think this is not a Buddhist sectarianism or anything like that. I didn't say anything about Buddhism. I said a path of liberation and awakening. Awakening means drawing forth the full potential of the greatest depths of your awareness. Wisdom, compassion, and there's this word power, and it is power. Power guided or motivated by compassion, guided by wisdom, is a fantastic thing, a many-splendored thing. Right? And so then if we are thinking along the lines, if that's where our heart moves us, if that heart was, well, what I'd really love to do would be to help people on this deepest level. And if we consider also that how many among the 7 billion people on the planet, many of them quite altruistic, at varying levels, but you know, really wanting to do some good, how many are really focusing on the hedonic? Because frankly, that's all they know about. They don't even know the word eudaimonia or any synonym or anything related to that. They think helping is helping people get some food, medical care, shelter, education, and so forth. And that's it. Okay. Well, of course, that's going to be where the mask, where government funding goes. Check, in terms of your government, how much money goes to the cultivation of eudaimonia. Brother, can you spare a dime? You know, probably not there. So, generally, what the world is aware of is hedonic suffering and hedonic well-being. And that's where almost all the philanthropy goes. Almost all of it. Right? But then, if you're aware that this is not just some doctrine or dogma or belief system, but that eudaimonia is real, it can be cultivated, then perhaps you feel called there. That's, you're now joined a very tiny minority. Of course, it's not just Buddhists, and it's not just religious people. Socrates spoke with great depth about eudaimonia. So did Aristotle. I don't think they're generally thought as, oh, such a religious figure. No, just such wise figure. So happily this eudaimonia, I love it. Because it. And then do scientists have any say? Yeah, scientists are starting to raise the issue too of eudaimonia. Psychologists, positive psychology. It's to say it's an infancy is maybe even an exaggeration, but at least they're starting to ask really good questions. And so scientists can bring in. Philosophers have a long history, and then the contemplative traditions, religious traditions of the world. So it's a unifier. It really is a unifier. It's really quite marvelous. So perhaps one feels moved there. And then if so, then consider Atisha. If that's what your passion is, if that's what you'd really love to do, is to help people find the authentic, true causes of suffering, and not only attenuate but eliminate them, find the true causes of genuine happiness and completely unveil them, if that's your passion, then you might want to think about developing the four immeasurables. And you might want to think about achieving shamatha and developing some of the abilities. Coming out of that, as Atisha said, if you've done that, then you can accrue more merit in one day than you can without it in 100 lifetimes. So that strikes me as a pretty good investment. So there it is. And then shamatha, of course, just opening the door. Just opening the door. Then imagine that the power, the clarity, the stability of shamatha flowing right into the four immeasurables and just whew, and having them all just go supernova. All the barriers just broken down. And then why would you stop with the four immeasurables? Go to the four greats. Mahamaitri, great loving kindness, great compassion, great mudita, great equanimity, and onto bodhicitta. And why stop there? Have it be uncontrived, spontaneous, genuine bodhicitta. Become a bodhisattva. Why stop there? For heaven's sakes, don't stop now. You've just put your foot on the path. Now make it irreversible. Seal it with profound insight into the four applications of mindfulness. Don't stop. Keep going. Gain a direct realization of emptiness. Don't stop. Break through your conventional mind. Realize Rigpa. Don't stop. Fully manifest all the potentials of your own Buddha nature. Become a Buddha. Don't stop. And now for as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, so continue to be present in the world. To alleviate the suffering of the world. It's a simple agenda. It's really quite simple. Yeah? So, in the midst of all of that, one may feel, but this in the midst of the needs of the world, how much suffering there is in the world, how many causes of suffering, evil, I mean, malevolence, dogmatism, closed-minded, intolerance, and so forth. It may feel a little bit, sometimes a bit trivial or a bit just selfish to think, may I be well and happy, may I be well and happy. If one is focusing entirely on hedonic well-being, in other words, every day of my life, may I be lucky, lucky, lucky. May only good things happen to me. Well, that's a bit trivial. And even if you're a Buddha, it's not going to happen, right? Even if you're a Buddha, everybody doesn't love you. You're, I think, a very lovable person if you're a Buddha. And still everybody doesn't love you. What a raw deal. You think, gosh, finally everybody will love me if I'm perfect. No, they still don't. It really sucks. They just get jealous of you and want to compete with you. Or even so jealous they want to kill you. Happens a lot. So, if one is focusing entirely on one's own hedonic well-being, well, it's pretty shallow water, that's for sure. Whereas if in your vision of your own flourishing, as you arouse the yearning, may I be well and happy, if you acknowledge the importance of hedonic well-being, which I've never doubted, but then you're focusing primarily the hedonic well-being is for the sake of genuine happiness. And what is genuine happiness? It's a symptom. Just as genuine unhappiness, you're sitting by your room with no stimuli coming in at all, just a room, and you're just miserable. That's genuine happiness. That's real. That's the real world. Grinding away at some mind-numbing job, coming home, eating and watching television, and then going comatose. That's an unreal world. Sitting in a room and feeling miserable all by yourself with homemade misery, made in, if you're in America, made in America. If you're a Chinese, made in China. And whoever you are, homemade misery. No help at all. I did it myself. Or as one slogan that came out, I built it. Well, it's coming from one's own mental afflictions. You're seeing something real. You're seeing a symptom of a mind that is afflicted. That's a good thing. It would be so tragic if we carried all of our mental afflictions and didn't experience any symptoms. Just felt, I'm fine, I'm fine. I'm brain dead. That'd be really tragic. So thank goodness the mental afflictions afflict. Otherwise they'd be totally useless. So recognizing that, then we say, okay, now I've gotten real. And now what? Now it's perfectly clear what's making me miserable, because there's nothing coming from outside at all. Therefore, it has to be internally generated. Therefore, I think I just figured out the source of suffering. You know? And likewise, when you're sitting in solitude, as one friend of mine who went on to about a 9-month retreat, totally solitary retreat, and when he came out of retreat, I saw this childlike delight in his face. And I didn't need to ask, but how'd your retreat go? And he said, it was like a river of gold. Like a river of gold. Right? So there's a person who's tapped into genuine happiness. It's a symptom. Genuine happiness is a symptom of a mind that is wonderfully balanced, rooted in a way of life that is nonviolent and truly benevolent. The two of these giving rise to genuine insight, the type of insight that transforms and liberates. So that you see, just sitting alone for months on end, having just enough food to keep your body going, exercise, bit of fresh air, that's all you need. In other words, you really don't, and you could be in that sensory deprivation tank, you could be in a dark, you know, in a dark retreat, because you really are not relying upon anything from the outside at all. It's like learning how to ride a bicycle, and at one point you just don't need the trainer wheels, the little wheels on the side. because you won't fall off? Hedonic pleasure is trainer wheels. And a person who can go into long-term retreat, like the elephant in the pond, the cat who's morphed from an elephant in the pond, and simply enjoying solitude, because it's a time simply to be with your mind in the universe, and it's a balanced mind for which the natural symptom is genuine happiness. That's the trainer wheels are taken off. You know how to ride. You now have a mind, and you can use it at will. It is supple. It is malleable. It's buoyant and light. It really works. It's serviceable. And then you go for the deeper, genuine happiness that comes from knowing reality as it is. So the wish for one's own well-being, especially when it's focusing or recognizing hedonic well-being, is for the sake of the eudaimonic well-being. And eudaimonic well-being is a symptom of a truly wholesome and meaningful way of life. That's where ethics is. A symptom of a truly balanced and composed and unified mind, which is samadhi. And a symptom of really coming to know reality as it is. Then there's absolutely nothing trivial about wishing oneself well, wishing that one may be truly well and happy. And to end on a purely pragmatic note, psychologists have studied this. Who's more productive? Who gets the job done? Who's more creative? People who are glum, dour, merely hardworking, determined, grinding their jaws, or people who are joyful, who are happy? There it is. Happiness is actually much more productive. It's good for others if you're happy. It's good for others. And then finally, one may feel, but I'm just one person and the world is so vast that even when I'm doing some, in some service occupation, for example, and really doing my best, it just doesn't matter at all. It hardly counts. What I'm offering is so trivial that it just makes me feel bad. And here's one of the symptoms of living in the modern world. And that is, if we lived in medieval Europe, as I've mentioned before, I think they commonly, the peasants and so forth, would not travel more than 10 miles from their home for the whole lifetime. So if they're tending their fields and being good parents and so forth, and they pretty much know their village and a few other villages, that's a pretty big wedge of reality. Oh, you are a good father, you're a good mother, you're a good you bake really good bread. Wow, you're the only baker in town. Thank you, that really counts, because we like our bread. You know, so you've got a real wedge of the pie there. If you're in a village of 100 people and you've never traveled more than 10 miles away from home, right? So you wouldn't feel your life is insignificant. But now here we are. We got 24-hour-day news of all the events, not all the events, but so much tragedy and misery taking place throughout the world that it's ever so easy to feel that whatever we do is never enough and it's insignificant. It's a drop in the bucket and it's insignificant. I don't think that's a realistic way of viewing. That if every one of the 7 billion people on the planet took as their fundamental priority, the first priority in terms of ways of being in the world, engaging with the world, each one steps out of their room, out of their house each morning with the prime directive, today let me do no harm. And today when I have the opportunity to be of service, to be of benefit, may I do so. Now, everything else comes after that. But that's the prime directive. If every person on the planet did that, we would be living in a utopia. They call this the Pure Land, Earth. Really, it would transform the whole planet, right? So if one person does that, then at least in the center of your mandala, you've just begun a utopia. You've begun a utopia. Whether you're working as a waitress in a restaurant, or I will briefly retell, and then I will end. The story I've told quite a few times about a woman in the Stanford bookstore. Remember? Some of you know this from the podcast, perhaps. I met her. She was just a woman in the woods, and she was selling stationery. She was in the stationery section, the office supplies. And I walked in there for one day to buy whatever office supplies. But I just noticed she was so warm, so gracious, so attentive. It was just a pleasure engaging with her. It was just so nice. And it was just so pure. Just so pure. It was just sheer benevolence. And nothing ostentatious. Like, would you like my liver? Would you like paper? My liver? Kidneys? Would you like pencils? Would you like a heart transplant? You know, it wasn't that. Nothing silly. It was just sheer benevolence, kindness, warmth flowed from her. And so I went in and made my purchase, and I just walked out of the room, out of the store feeling, wow, she was really nice. And just that, I mean, just really, wow, that was, I hope you see there's nothing more complicated than that. It was just that. She was just so kind, you know? And I went home, well, oh, and here I am talking about it. This is like 20 years later, right? But then what did really catch my attention is a couple of months later, I was reading the Stanford Daily newspaper. And one of the journalists for the newspaper wrote a whole article about her. And she can simply continue doing what she did with me, with everybody else, of course, because I never had the sense that, oh, she thinks I'm special. That thought never came to mind. And if it did, it would be delusional. There was nothing special about me at all. But she just treated one customer after another with this just loving kindness, this benevolence, this warmth, this happiness. You know? And then they just got caught on. And some journalist said, wow, that's really remarkable, and wrote a whole article about her. And when I read it, I said, yep, that's the one. You know? So selling stationery is generally not a profession for which you'll get a Nobel Peace Prize. You know. But one can see that this woman, day by day, office supply by office supply, was really making a contribution. So there it is. Let's practice loving kindness following the teachings of the Buddha. Motivated by the aspiration of loving kindness for yourself and others, enact that aspiration by venturing into the practice and settling your body, speech, and mind in the natural state. And now envision your own well-being. Hedonically, eudaimonically. Bring to mind your heart's desire and attend to the causes that would yield such a fruit. Consider the possibility as a working hypothesis that when it comes to flourishing, comes to eudaimonia, whatever you can imagine for yourself, you can realize you do have the potential. For your potential has no bounds. It is limitless. We may not know whether that statement is true or not, but as a working hypothesis, it has tremendous potential. And imagine this potential symbolically as an incandescent, limitless orb of light at your heart. With each out-breath, arouse this aspiration. May I be truly well and happy. May I find the causes of happiness. With each out-breath, imagine a flow of light from this orb at your heart, emanating out in all directions, completely filling your entire being. This light of loving kindness, the light of purity, and the light of joy. Imagine this light throughout your whole being consuming everything that obscures, afflicts the body, afflicts the mind. Imagine it dispelling all obstacles. letting your imagination play. Imagine this light flowing from the deepest dimension of your existence, from the dimension of primordial consciousness, indivisible from the absolute space of phenomena, the Dhamma Dhatu, indivisible from the energy of primordial consciousness, the three coextensive. And as this light at your heart, drawing from that source, permeates your entire being, imagine it entirely consuming the materiality of your body, right down to the level of elementary particles. Imagine it all dissolving away, the materiality of your body settling in its natural state, the pure energy of primordial consciousness. And where your material body was, imagine only this remains, a body of light. Like a holographic image, luminous but empty. Now, as if your whole being is formed to superabundance, to the point of overflowing with this light, with each out-breath extend this field of light in all the directions around you, above and below. Imagine this sphere of light extending in all directions, expanding breath by breath, and as you do so, with every out-breath arouse the yearning. May each of us find happiness and the true causes of happiness. With every out-breath, imagine this sphere of light expanding, and as one sentient being after another is embraced within this sphere, imagine each one finding or realizing their heart's desire, finding genuine happiness and its causes. imagine each individual, each sentient being who's embraced within the sphere of light of loving kindness, finding the joy and the satisfaction, the fulfillment that they seek here and now. Expand this realm of possibility in all directions, greater and greater. Let this field of light expand to the extent that it embraces the entire planet and all the sentient beings inhabiting it. And then exponentially expand the field in all directions, out beyond our tiny corner of the galaxy, to embrace the entire galaxy and all the beings within it, and out in all directions, stretch your imagination to try to imagine imagining 100 billion galaxies and all the beings who dwell therein. May each one be well and happy. imagine each one realizing their innermost desire. Realizing full awakening. And release all appearances and all aspirations. Let your awareness rest, knowing it so. Enjoy your day.